father or seen their mother get killed. Tommy, Vince, and Nikki didn't have problems like that. They were so fucking young they hadn't even begun to live. The whole process was hardest on Tommy, I think, because he'd gotten to the point of being ultra-temperamental when he was rotted, and after a blow-up at his house on Christmas Eve, he needed to get sober to save his marriage. He was just a baby when the band took off, and I guess you lose your sense of perspective when you're a teenage millionaire. The deal we made was that before we started recording the new album, we all had to be sober. So the guys would check into rehab, go on a binge, then check into rehab again to sober up for a week. It was like an expensive vacation because all these therapists and clinic owners would do was take as much money out of those guys as they could and keep it whether the guys got sober or not. Maybe, if you were lucky, they'd use your tens of thousands of dollars to buy you a free keychain after 90 days of sobriety. The way I see it, you can only quit when you want to, and all the rehabs in the world aren't going to help you. That's my opinion, because not going to rehab worked very well for me. My only vice now is collecting old guitars. Maybe that's why I'm the boring guy of the band. Even though I quit by myself, I still had to go to group meetings and therapy. Our management was trying to do some kind of extensive plastic surgery on the band, and we had to see all these doctors who would try to brainwash us into behaving differently. Once a week, we'd have to go to relationship counseling, like an old, bitter married couple. There, we'd learn how to talk to each other instead of fighting, or we'd discuss our feelings and whatever was going on that week. It bummed me out. First of all, it messed up my day having to go there and sit through something I wasn't into and didn't believe in. And secondly, it hurt my feelings that the rest of the band wasn't strong enough to see through the superficial therapy bullshit and just get along on their own. Every therapist wanted us to let loose and cry, and I hate crybabies. Grown men who cry in the middle of a fucking crisis will die, because you can bet your ass that the enemy won't be crying. They'll be killing your weak ass while you cry. My father taught me, when you're a child, be a child. When you're a man, be a man. I became so sick of seeing everyone in the band bawling their eyes out. Go back to the second grade if you want to cry, suck ass. The ideas behind all that expensive therapy were so simple. Stay away from alcohol and drugs and things that make you misbehave. Think before acting on a negative impulse, and share your feelings instead of keeping them bottled in where they destroy you and those around you. We all knew that beforehand. The only bad habit we had was therapy. But I went every week anyway without a complaint because I didn't need a therapist to tell me that if we wanted to be a great band again, we had to stick together like a band. We moved to Canada to record our next album, and the substance abuse therapists came with us, on our dime. When we finished and returned to L.A., I was walking through a shopping center in Beverly Hills buying furniture for a new house I had moved into with Emmy and couldn't really afford. From across the street, a woman yelled, "Mick!" She looked like a bag lady and reeked of alcohol. She was so rotted she could hardly walk. I said hi to her and moved on. "Who was that freak?" Emmy asked. "Her?" I replied. "That was our therapist."
Chapter 4. Nikki. Love catches our hero unawares as he beseeches his muse for guidance in pursuing a craft he has long abandoned, that of writing a song. As soon as I emerged clean from months of on-and-off rehab torture, one of the first people I saw was Demi Moore, the very person who had first whispered the letters AA in my ear. She was in Vancouver filming a movie while we were starting to work on Dr. Feelgood. And word on the street was that Demi and Bruce Willis had separated. We had dinner at my producer Bob Rock's house, and afterward she asked if I wanted a ride back to her hotel. Sometimes a ride home is just a ride home. But being a rock star, I naturally assumed I was being offered another kind of ride. I knew I was sober for real this time when I turned that ride down. The reason was Brandy Brandt. Since the age of 7, when I started smoking pot in Mexico, there was hardly a day that went by when I hadn't gotten fucked up. I'd been successfully avoiding reality for 20 years solid. So when I finally got off heroin, I didn't know what to do with myself. Sobriety was terrifying. I had a whole life to catch up on, and I didn't know where to begin or what to do with myself. I didn't go to clubs anymore, and I hadn't been laid in so long that me and my right hand were basically engaged. I became so confused and agoraphobic that I went to see a psychiatrist. All the rehab and therapy had peeled back the onion so deep that I didn't feel like Nikki Six anymore. I felt like that little boy in Idaho, super geek and friend to Alan Weeks. I needed to learn all over again how to be a man, because I realized that all along I had been nothing but a little boy, immature, impulsive, and highly susceptible to the evils of the world. The therapist suggested that I try a new drug called Prozac. Though I didn't want to take any drugs, even legal ones, he said that I had become chemically unbalanced. My substance abuse, he explained, had knocked the production of something in my brain called serotonin out of whack. He gave me two boxes, each filled with 10 samples of this new wonder drug. As I walked out the door, I popped two pills, and by the time I was home, I felt calm. Maybe it was a placebo, but within 2 days I was able to leave the house and even socialize a little. I went on a date with Lisa Hartman, but she was too busy for me, though she evidently wasn't too busy for Clint Black. In fact, most of my so-called friends didn't have time for me anymore. Some of the guys from Metallica walked up to me at the cat house and offered to buy me a drink. But when I said I was sober, they walked away and wouldn't speak to me. Same with Slash. Same with everybody. Fortunately, an old friend named Eric Stacy, who played bass in Faster Pussycat, had also just gotten out of rehab. I invited him to live with me so we could both sit around and feel like dorks together. Every now and then, we would venture out to a club and try to pick up chicks. But either we had forgotten how, or we never really knew how. We'd say, hi. They'd say, hi. Then there would be an awkward silence, and we'd say, never mind. Eventually, Ricky Rachtman, who ran the cat house, felt so sorry for me and my right hand that he set us up on a blind date with Miss October. Though a date isn't so blind when you know it's with a Playboy centerfold. I was an emotionally vulnerable rock star on Prozac exploring a new world of sobriety, and she was a playmate on the rebound. It was a bad combination. Brandy, a voluptuous brunette with sparkling childlike eyes, had just broken up with Tie Me Down of Faster Pussycat after finding a used rubber in his trash can. The first night we slept together at her house, the phone rang. It was Brandy's mother. Through the receiver, I could hear her mom talking about a guy she had met a while back named Nicky, and how she was thinking of calling him because she had really liked him. I recognized that voice. It was Bree Howard, one of the girls we had auditioned as a backup singer on the girls' tour. I had completely forgotten about her. We had a fun couple of nights rolling around together, but I had no idea she was Brandy's... Mom? Brandy said. I wouldn't advise calling Nikki. Maybe you should call that nice record producer I saw you with the other week. My life felt so empty without drugs that I let Brandy fill the void. It was so exciting to actually be hanging out with someone of the opposite sex and enjoying it that I leapt into a relationship. But I was a child. I needed to be in love with someone, and I needed to feel like someone loved me. Sobriety had allowed me to feel emotions again, but it hadn't taught me how to interpret them. Just a couple weeks after Brandy and I met, I had to move to Vancouver to record the Dr. Feelgood album, and the distance added more fuel to the illusion of being in love. Though I was lonely and depressed without her, at the same time, without the need to take drugs or chase pussy every night, I found myself actually doing something productive with my time and writing songs again. The experiences of the last year had given me more than enough material, with my near-death overdose inspiring the album's first song, Kickstart My Heart. I always managed to get a song out of each overdose. This wasn't like Girls, 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 where I kicked my habit just long enough to write some album filler. I had the time and clarity to cut away the fat of my writing, get together with the band, and put the songs through the Motley machine, discussing and changing each until we all liked them. We had been through months of meetings where the band accused me of being a fascist about my songs and vision, So for the first time, I listened to them and took their input. The friendship between Tommy and me deepened as he immersed himself in the songwriting process and started waking me up every morning to go over new ideas. Perhaps because my issues with my father had kept me from forming any real friendships, Tommy became my first and only best friend in that time. Clear-headed, we now had the patience to listen to bands besides The Sweet, Slade, T-Rex, Aerosmith, and the New York Dolls. I opened my mind to everything from Miles Davis to Whitney Houston, and I became aware of a whole universe of sound and emotion, of intricate melodies, bass lines, and rhythms that I had missed out on all my life. Together, we all wrote what we thought could be our best album yet. For once, the studio wasn't a place to party and bring chicks. It was a place to work, and work it was. We had brought in Bob Rock as a producer because we liked the albums he had done with Kingdom Come, The Cult, and Ted Nugent. It was his job to get us to be Motley Crue again after having been decimated by a decade of drugs and deaths and marriages and rehab. Where Tom Werman just said, "Okay, good enough," Bob whipped us like galley slaves. His line was, "That just isn't your best." Nothing was good enough. Mick recorded all the guitar for Shout at the Devil in 2 weeks, but now Bob Rock would make him spend 2 weeks doubling a guitar part over and over until it was perfectly synchronized. And even though the process aggravated and frustrated Mick, he had it much easier than Vince, who on some days would only get a single word on tape that Bob liked. Bob was critical, demanding, and a stickler for punctuality. 6 months of rigor combined with 6 months of sobriety tore the life out of us, and we all had to put up with each other's violent and sudden mood swings. Before we walked in the studio each day, we never knew whether we'd leave that evening feeling like the best band in the world or four angry clowns who couldn't even play their instruments. In 8 years together and with millions of albums sold, we had never recorded properly. No one had ever pushed us to the limits of our abilities before or kept demanding more than we thought we could give until we discovered that we actually did have more to give. We had just never tried before. Aerosmith was recording Pump in the studio next to us and meeting with the same counselor we were using, Bob Timmons. So after work, we'd do the kinds of ridiculous things that sober rock stars do together, like drink Perrier or jog around a lake. Of course, the whole process was the antithesis of every punk principle I had held fast to as a teenager. I still loved loud, raw, sloppy, mistake-filled rock and roll. I wanted same old situation to drip with filth, Dr. Feelgood to have a groove that could kick heads in, kickstart my heart to sound as frantic as a speedball, and Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away, to have a chorus you could destroy your room to. But, at the same time, I wanted an album I was finally proud of. In rehab, they had told me that the only way to get clean is by believing in and seeking the help of a higher power that could return sanity to my life. Most people chose God or love. I chose the only woman who hadn't abandoned me my whole life, music, and it was time to pay her back for her faith and perseverance. I was running on blind faith, though. Overwhelmed with excitement about the new material we were working so hard on, we had no idea that the music industry had pretty much said that we were over after Girls, Girls, Girls. We had been around for an entire decade, and as far as they were concerned, that was long enough. The 80s were almost over. Things were brewing in Seattle, and we were just a hairspray metal band that had gotten lucky with a couple singles. In their minds, we were dead and gone. They wrote us off early.
Chapter 5. Tommy. An adventure entered into with a sense of civic duty and professional obligation ends in the bitter taste of abandonment, disloyalty, and salted airline peanuts. Just before the Girls, Girls, Girls tour, Heather and I caused the downfall of one of the country's biggest fucking coke dealers. And it was all because we didn't want to go to Jamaica alone. Our manager, Doc McGee, had a lot of suspicious friends who lived in the Caymans. They were these crazy, macked-out guys with only first names, Jerry, Lay, Tony, and they'd bring huge fucking suitcases full of coke and cash to the island, where they'd launder their money without the IRS getting up into their shit. Lay, a tan, suave, filthy, rich southerner, was one of the coolest of Doc's friends. I had originally met him with Vince when we were chilling in the Caymans. Lay walked into Doc's rental house with an attaché case, and the first words we spoke to him were, "Gimme, gimme, gimme!" Because we knew what was in that fucking attaché case. Mountains of white powder to stuff up our noses. Lay opened the case and gave us a little rock. "That's all you're giving us?" Vince yelled at him. "I'll tell you what," Lay said. "If you can open the case, you can have more." And with that, he gave us a knowing wink, shut the case, dropped a lock clasp, and spun the combination dial so we couldn't open it. We had that entire rock in our system in 10 minutes, and then, as always happens when you're high on coke, we started fiending hardcore for more. Vince and I grabbed the suitcase and tried every single combination. We were so coked out that we actually thought we were coming up with every single permutation of three numbers. "Wait!" Vince would yell in a flash of inspiration. "Have we tried 666 yet?" Finally, I went into the kitchen, grabbed a butcher knife, and cut the top of Lay's $1,000 leather briefcase. Glittering inside like white gold were fucking dozens of huge plastic bags filled with coke. We slit them open and just dove in like we were bobbing for apples. After an hour of white heaven, Doc walked in. "What the fuck are you doing?" Vince looked up at him, his face white with coke and slobber.
"Well, Lay said we could have it if we opened it, and we opened it."
Doc was fucking pissed and kicked us out of the apartment. I think we ended up paying for all the drugs we destroyed out of our royalties. Not long after that, Lay got busted. He used to have super hot chicks fly in to meet him in the Caymans for a few days, always different girls coming two at a time. And we just thought that he was a Mac fucking daddy. But the truth is that he was using them as mules to bring drugs into the U.S. One time, these killer blondes came down from New Orleans and kicked it with Doc, Lay, and the guys from Bon Jovi, who Doc was also managing. When it came time for the girls to leave, Lay taped drugs all over their bodies and dropped them off at the airport. It was their first time smuggling, so one of them had the bright idea of duct taping scissors to her body. That way, if she was in danger of being caught, she could just cut the drugs loose. Well, Einstein and her friend went through the metal detector, and of course the scissors set it off. They searched her, found the coke, then searched her friend. It's a small island, and they knew the girls were with Lay and the Bon Jovi guys who had left the island on the previous flight. So they made the plane Bon Jovi was on turn around so they could search everyone's luggage for drugs. Then they sent cops looking for Lay, who jumped on his jet and went into hiding on another island before they could catch him. And that's when Heather and I came in. We wanted to go to Jamaica, but we didn't know anybody there, and Lay, of course, was connected to fucking everyone in the Caribbean. So we had Doc get in touch with him, and he said he'd meet us in Jamaica to show us around. Unbeknownst to him, however, the feds had made a deal with the Jamaican government, and the second his plane touched down in Kingston, they surrounded it, pulled him off, put him on a jet for Tampa, and arrested him there. Heather and I felt terrible. We had no one to show us around Jamaica. Shit turned out cool for Lay, though. He got sentenced to life in prison, sent us a couple letters, and then we didn't hear from him. Next thing I knew, when we were in Tampa on the Decade of Decadence tour, Lay was at the show, decked out in fucking Armani. He wouldn't tell me how he weaseled out of a life sentence in less than 10 years, but he did claim that he was keeping his nose clean. By then, I was keeping my nose clean, too. So was our manager, Doc McGee. Before he met us, he was living a secret life that blew up on him when he got busted for helping smuggle 40,000 fucking pounds of pot from Colombia into North Carolina. It wasn't his only bust, because he was also being accused of associating with some well-connected madmen who had conspired to bring over 500,000 pounds of blow and weed into the United States in the early 80s. So, just as we were going through rehab, the law slapped Doc with a $15,000 fine and a 5-year suspended prison sentence, and made him set up an anti-drug organization, the Make a Difference Foundation, after he pled guilty in the North Carolina case. Doc knew that anyone else probably would have been in jail for at least 10 years for that shit, so he had to do something high profile to show the court he was doing the world some good as a free man. And his brainstorm was to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Woodstock with the Moscow Music Peace Festival, a giant spectacle of sobriety and international love that included us, Ozzy, the Scorpions, and Bon Jovi. All the money was supposed to go to anti-drug and anti-alcohol charities, including the Make a Difference Foundation. But it was all bad from the moment we stepped on the plane. We had a pact as a band that we were gonna stay sober. And as a sober band, we were gonna take our music to the fucking top. Dr. Feelgood was coming out in a couple weeks, and Doc told us that a warm-up show in Moscow would be a great way to kick it off. He explained that everyone would be equal on the bill. There would be no headliners, and everyone would play a stripped-down 50-minute show with no props or special effects. The running order would be the Scorpions, Ozzy, us, and then Bon Jovi. But as soon as we stepped on Doc's plane, which was covered with stupid psychedelic hippie paintings by Peter Max, memories of the theater and girls' tours flooded back. We were looking at a day-long plane ride with absolutely nothing to do. Then, there was a so-called doctor on board who was plying the bands who weren't sober with whatever medicine they needed. It was clear that this was going to be a monumental festival of hypocrisy. Even Mick was in a shitty mood the whole flight. He had been helping pay for all our drug problems for a year. Now here he was, flying to Moscow to help pay his management, the guys who were supposed to be taking care of us, for their drug problems. When we arrived at the gig, it started to become clear that this was a total clusterfuck, and Doc had told each band something different in order to get them to do the show. John Bon Jovi thought it was just another stop on his world headlining tour, while we thought it was supposed to be a small-scale, reduced set. Then the production manager broke the news to us that we'd been demoted. We were on before Ozzy and the Scorpions. I was fucking livid. Doc was supposed to be our manager, looking out for our best interests, and he was favoring one of his newer clients, Bon Jovi, over us, and the Scorpions, who in Russia were massive. "Fuck you, Doc," Nikki said to him. "We didn't fly all the way to Russia to be an opening act while Bon fucking Jovi gets to headline for an hour and a half. What's up with that?" "Dude, we are fucking going home," I screamed at Doc. I was pissed. "This show isn't even about us. It's about Bon Jovi." "You guys can't do that," Doc pleaded. "That's fucked up." "Hey," Nikki said. "We're not doing anything wrong. You told us something that wasn't true. You said that everyone was supposed to be equal on this show, and now every band is getting more time than us. This is turning into a fucking joke." Finally, Doc appeased us. And, more out of respect for Ozzy, who took us on tour with him when no one knew shit about us and was now playing with our friend Randy Castillo on drums, we said we'd do it. We played a decent show the first night, and it felt good to be busting out Dr. Feelgood and Same Old Situation live for the first time. Ozzy was fucking crazy and great as usual, and the Russians went ballistic for the Scorpions. The audience, which was about 125,000 people, started to stream out of the theater after the Scorpions. But then old John made his grand entrance, right through the middle of the audience, as lines of Russian police officers split the crowd in front of him like the Red Sea. As soon as he reached the front, the whole stage went boom! Fireworks and flash pots and pyrotechnics exploded into the air. The crowd went ape shit, while I fucking shit in my pants. You need to get permits to get those kind of pyrotechnics into Russia. And it was clear that Doc knew all along what Bon Jovi was planning for its show. So, as soon as those bombs went off, everyone in the crew and other bands looked at us. They knew that someone was about to get hurt. I hunted Doc down and found him backstage. I walked right up to him and pushed him in his fat little chest, knocking him over onto the ground like a broken weevil. As he lay there, Nikki broke the news.
"Doc, you lied to us again. This time, you're fucking fired."
We did the honorable thing and played the next day. Then had our tour manager book us a flight home on Air France. We didn't want to have anything more to do with helping Doc pay his legal bills. We flew back via Paris and New York and talked with Doug Thaler about ditching Doc and helping him start his own company to take care of us. The whole ride home we felt like suckers for even going to Russia, but also like dumb fucks for dumping our management on the eve of releasing the first record we ever really felt pumped about. I hold myself up with Heather, just depressed and fighting the urge every day to make a big to-go order from the liquor store. I did interviews, I listened to the radio a little, and I could feel maybe a little momentum growing, but I had no idea. Then, on October 3, my 27th birthday, I received a fax. It was from Nikki. If you could have just one thing on your birthday, some way for the world to say that it will all be okay, then I would wish for you with all my heart a number one album on the Billboard chart. Happy birthday, Tommy. You have a number one album. I drove to the newsstand, bought Billboard magazine, and had the album chart shellacked and mounted. Then I called everyone I knew.
Chapter 6. Doc McGee. A manager bids a bittersweet adieu to his incorrigible charges. It was a dark time in my life, and I was trying to do something about it. I was trying to do something for everybody, for the world, for the bands, and for myself. The Moscow Music Peace Festival wasn't like promoting a festival in Poughkeepsie or Woodstock. This was something completely new, and nobody got it. For the bands, it was all about them and who got what time slot and who got the biggest dressing room and how come someone got to shoot a firework off. By the time the show started, I was tired of hearing all the bitches bitch. Since Nikki's overdose, I knew that Motley and I had to split for one simple reason. I didn't like them. There was nothing I liked about them. I had to start dealing with my life and the bands in my life that were willing to let me help them. Motley never let me help. Instead, we just beat the shit out of each other. It had taken me a decade to get to that point with Motley Crue. From the moment I first saw them at the Santa Monica Civic Center and rode home in a merchandise truck that was completely empty because the guys had sold every single item, I knew they were beginning a career that could only go up. But I had no idea that as human beings, they were in such a complete downward spiral. I've managed Mink DeVille, James Brown, The Scorpions, Skid Row, Bon Jovi, and Kiss. I've been dragged through the deepest shit by all kinds of mentally ill people, but I have never been through what Motley Crue put me through. One day, Mick would try to jump out a window. "Why'd you do that?" I would ask. "I don't know." The next day, Nikki would punch some guy in a suit off a bar stool. "Why'd you do that?" "I don't know." The next day, Tommy, the happiest kid in the second grade, would knock me on my ass. "Why'd you do that?" "I don't know." Every day was like that. It was a constant. We were thrown out of hotels in every city. That's the difference between chicken shit and chicken salad. They weren't like Poison who raised hell because they thought that was what rock stars should be doing. Motley Crue did stupid things because they were Motley Crue. There was no reason for anything. Just a motley reason. They didn't even have to try. Their life was the rock and roll life. That band was poised to be the Zeppelin of its era, but they could never get it together. Even today, I still believe that they could come out roaring again with something that's new and meaningful and true to where they are at in their lives. But if they do accomplish that, it's not going to be with me. I've already spent 10 years of my life apologizing for that band. As their manager, that's all I really did, apologize. For years afterward, I'd walk into a hotel lobby and the receptionist would call to me, "Mr. McGee," and I'd run up and drop to my knees and say, "Oh, Jesus, I'm really sorry." They'd look at me funny and say, "No, nothing's wrong. You have a telephone call." And I'd breathe a sigh of relief and thank the good Lord above that I wasn't managing Motley Crue anymore.
Chapter 7. Vince. Of a most unchivalrous duel with Axl Rose, a flower by any other name. Charisse was your average mud wrestler. Blonde hair, big tits, and a killer hard body. When the girls from the Tropicana came back to my house to wrestle for my friends, she was always the most vicious fighter. She won every time and looked good doing it. She was just my type. When we started going out, she stopped dancing. Instead, she developed a $20,000 a month purse habit. And instead of wrestling other chicks, she fought with me all the time. Sobriety may have been easy for the other guys, but I was being driven to drink every night. Before the Feel Good album came out, I called up some of my buddies and went whitewater rafting down Snake River in Idaho for 10 days. It was the best way I could think of to stay sober, away from Charisse, the telephone, the band, the bars. It was just sunshine, rapids, and exercise. As soon as we returned to civilization, I called Charisse and she was in tears. I was at the cat house, she sobbed, and Izzy was hitting on me. Izzy Stradlin? Yeah, he was all fucked up, and I told him to get his hands off me because I was your wife. Then he grabbed my shirt and pulled it down. That fucking asshole! But that's not even the bad part. I slapped him across the face, of course, and then he karate kicked me as hard as he could. In the stomach. He knocked the wind out of me. It really hurt, and everyone saw it. That little shit. The next time I see his motherfucking ass, I'm gonna fucking kill him. Oh yeah, I almost forgot, she added. Your album's number one. I don't think anyone had disrespected me like that since the bikers outside the whiskey hit on Beth and Lita so many years ago. But Izzy wasn't a biker. He was the guitarist in Guns N' Roses. I had taken that fucking band on tour as an opening act for a few of the girl shows when nobody believed in them. They were nice then. Axel was a shy, humble guy. It was a lot of fun to be with. But now they were starting to believe their own press clippings. And this guy, who was supposed to be my friend, was disrespecting my wife. Did you hear me? Your record's number one. Izzy had picked the wrong time to fuck with me, because the MTV Video Music Awards were just weeks away at the Universal Amphitheater. At the show, I left the band waiting in their limos outside and hung around backstage while Guns N' Roses played with Tom Petty. When Izzy walked off stage, looking like a cross between Eric Stoltz and Mask and Neil Young, I was waiting for him. You fucking hit my wife! So fucking what? He spat. All my blood rushed into my fist and I decked him. I decked him good, right in the face. He fell to the ground like a tipped cow. Fred Saunders pinned my arms. The next time you fucking touch her, I'll fucking kill you! I yelled at Izzy's prone body as Fred dragged me away. I shook myself loose and we walked toward the door to make our escape. Before we reached the exit, Axel came snarling after us like an overdressed Doberman. Come on, motherfucker, I'm gonna fucking kill you! He yelled at our backs. I twirled around. His face was sweaty and twisted. Let's fucking go, I said to him, and I meant it. The blood was still pumping into my fists. He looked at me and squeaked like a little bitch. Just don't fuck with my band again, okay? And he walked away. Then Axel suddenly launched a press campaign about me. If I was a record, he would have sold millions of copies of me. Every article I read, every time I turned on the TV, he was claiming that I had sucker-punched Izzy and been insulting Guns N' Roses for years, and he pledged to put me in my place, which was 6 feet under the earth. It was like rock and roll had suddenly turned into the World Wrestling Federation. It was such a betrayal. I had every right to knock Izzy on his ass, and it was none of Axel's business. On the girls' tour, Axel would come to me when his throat hurt, and I'd show him the tricks I'd developed for singing after a night spent destroying my vocal cords. Now he was sending little messengers to me, with instructions to meet him in the parking lot of Tower Records on Sunset, or on the boardwalk of Venice Beach. Even though it was such a high school way of settling our differences, I showed up every time, because the only thing that would have given me more pleasure than a number one album on the pop charts was breaking Axl Rose's nose. But Axel never showed. It finally got to the point that whenever he arranged a fight somewhere, I just sent some people to the spot to call me if and when he appeared. Maybe someone else would have just let it drop after Axel chickened out a good half dozen times, but I was pissed. He was in the press acting like he was king of the world, saying that I couldn't fight and that he was a red belt and this and that. But in real life, he was too chicken shit to back up his word. So I finally went on MTV with a message for him. I said that if Axel wanted to fight me, that he should do it in front of the whole world. I proposed Monday night, fight night, at the Forum. We'd go 3 rounds, and then the world would see who the pussy was. I was ready to go. I didn't even care about Izzy anymore. I dealt with him. He even called and apologized for what he did to Charisse. As for Slash and Duff McKagan, we were friends through it all. They knew what an asshole Axel was. I wanted to beat the shit out of that little punk and shut him up for good. But I never heard from him. Not that day, not that month, not that year, not that century. But the offer still stands.
Chapter 8. Tommy. Like brave Ulysses, sailing homeward from battle, our heroes find that powers on high have conspired to keep them lost at sea. We didn't hang out. We didn't party. We didn't stick our dicks where they didn't belong. We just flew into a city, played our asses off, and got the fuck out of there. For the first time, we were operating like a machine instead of four untamed animals. But then we started getting treated like a machine. The tour started off as this beautiful dream. We had our first number one album, which was so insanely popular that every damn song but one ended up on a single. We were on the cover of every magazine, and we had a big-ass stage show that filled dozens of trucks and went beyond anything we could have imagined when we were sitting in the Motley House setting Nikki on fire. There were 36 Marshall stacks, 36 SVT stacks, and a kick-ass flying drum set, which I'd been fantasizing about all my life. The crowds were fanatical. They knew every lyric, every chord, every downbeat off every album. And for the first time, we were sober enough to appreciate it, and married enough. We all had new wives or fiancés to whom we wanted to stay faithful. I was with Heather, Mick was engaged to Emmy, Vince had Charisse, and Nikki had proposed to Brandy, though he probably wasn't looking forward to Thanksgiving at her mother's house. Motley Crue was now four dudes in the best physical shape they'd been in since they were born. But then fall faded to winter. Winter turned to spring, and spring bloomed to summer, and we were still on the road with no sign of stopping. Elektra was still releasing singles from the album, and Doug Thaler, who was managing us by himself, had us booked into tours and festivals for another year solid. After a while, it didn't matter how much bank we were making or how many weeks our album had been in the top 40. We just couldn't bring ourselves to put those leather pants on again for another night. Maybe if we were allowed to tour with cooler opening acts like Iggy Pop or Husker Du instead of being forced to bring along cheesy pop metal posers like Warrant and Whitesnake, our morale would have been better. Maybe if we had a week off sometimes, a little time in the Bahamas to veg out, we could have made it through the tour sane. But the record label was worried we'd lose our momentum. We were a money machine. They were going to keep working us until we broke. And dude, break we did. The beginning of the end was a flying drum solo in New Haven, Connecticut. For me, it was always so crucial for people to see what I was doing when I played. In the early Motley days, I tried to use mirrors, but that never really worked. Then, before the Girls, Girls, Girls tour, I had a crazy-ass dream that I was playing drums in a cage while spinning around and gyroscoping. So, we rigged up the Sketto contraption where a forklift would take the drums to the front of the stage, and a motor would spin the drums around while I played upside down and shit. At first, I would get really dizzy, but then I remembered something I had learned in ballet lessons as a kid, and started picking a spot on the wall to stare at while spinning. On the Feel Good tour, I wanted to get even closer to the bros in the audience, so we rigged up the flying drum set, and it was all good. Until New Haven. To this day, I still don't know what happened. It began like usual. During Mick's solo, I sneaked into this long tube, stuck my feet into a strap hanging there, and wrapped my hand around a rope, which was attached to a chain motor that slowly pulled me up to the top rafters at the New Haven Coliseum. I chilled up there for a while, looking 80 feet down to scope out Mick's solo and the audience, who couldn't see me yet. Then, with a rigger named Norman holding on to me, I leapt into the air, grabbed the drums, and kicked my body around into the seat. Below, Mick shot some crazy shit out of his guitar. His stacks rumbled like they were about to explode. And then the drums appeared. Whoosh! Over the heads of the audience in the midst of all this really dramatic music. As the audience went out of their minds, I started hitting all these electronic pads. Blam, 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 as the drums shot down toward them on 100 or so feet of invisible track. I cruised over the heads of the people on the floor, then shot to the very back of the place, so that the dudes in the full-on Stevie Wonder section all of a sudden had front-row seats. There was one dude in a jeans jacket who, I swear to God, shit in his pants when all of a sudden I was inches away from his face playing drums in the air. Then I spun around, and the whole track adjusted so I could get back up to the top of the arena. I triggered a sample of a long descending sound, like someone jumping off a bridge.
Oh!
Then put my foot back in the strap, grabbed the rope that originally carried me up, and prepared to jump. It was Norman's job to pull the handbrake at the last minute, so that I'd screech to a halt like 5 feet over the heads of the crowd, and then just bounce there on this elastic rope. I liked it to look insane. None of this fucking Gene Simmons fly me over the fucking audience like Peter Pan shit. I wanted to be fully dropped, freefall style. So I sprung off the rafter.
Oh!
The air whipped past my face. Whoosh! And then I prepared myself mentally for Norman to pull the brake. But as I neared the ground, for some reason I inexplicably lost my trust in him. I didn't think he was going to stop me in time. So I panicked and tried to bail out. I let go of the rope and tried to get my foot out of the strap. I think the sheer exhaustion of so many back-to-back shows had dulled my senses. As soon as Norman saw me struggling to get loose, he hit the brake. Instantly, my foot, which was still in the strap, fucking stopped midair while the rest of my body continued to fall. I was just a few feet over the audience and my skull fucking smacked against the head of some dude in the audience. And then, because the rope had so much elasticity, I hit the ground head first and blacked out. The next thing I heard was, "Rew, rew." I couldn't remember a thing other than the fact that something had gone wrong.
"What happened to me?" I asked. "You just fell, buddy."
"I did?"
"You fell on your head."
"Where?"
"At the concert."
"The concert? I need to be at my concert."
I panicked. That was making no sense. I didn't remember having fallen. I just knew that I was supposed to be on stage.
Not in a...
"Where am I?"
"You're in an ambulance. We're taking you to the hospital."
"But..."
"The show's over, buddy. Now relax." We ended up canceling a show or two while I recovered from my concussion. 3 days later, I found myself facing arena rafters and the elastic rope again. Norman pumped the brakes that I descended really slowly, like some sort of fairy godmother instead of a rock and roll madman, and he stopped me 20 feet above the audience instead of 5. It took me a while to get over the fear. The rest of the band was thankful for the extra days off, but afterward, it was back to the never-ending roadshow. As exhaustion and insanity kicked in, our lives started to unravel. First, the chicks came marching in. Before the encore, we would marinate in a little tent in the back of the stage and suck down cold mineral water. One day we were chilling back there when Nikki pointed out a cat litter box that was mysteriously sitting in the middle of the floor. As we were trying to figure out who was stupid enough to keep a cat backstage, we heard a loud meow. A girl came crawling toward the box on her hands and knees wearing a cat collar and a leash led by a roadie. Vince looked at me for an explanation. I looked at Nikki. Nikki looked at Mick, and Mick looked back at Vince. No one knew what was going on. The girl crawled into the cat box, hiked up her dress, peed in the sand, and then scratched at the litter until she had covered her mess. Soon, we were finding ways out of the drudgery by amusing ourselves with stupid human tricks and watching our road crew reach new lows. A whole cat theme began to develop, based around the line, "Here, kitty, kitty," from Same Old Situation. The roadies would stand in a circle and jerk off into their hands, while some poor but willing girl crawled around meowing on all fours and licking it out of their hands like milk. Nikki thought it was funny, but then again, Nikki has mother issues. What began as a clean and wholesome tour had, near the end, turned into a sick sexual circus. We were sober and had nothing else to do, so the girls became our only entertainment. Once we started looking at the girls, we noticed that they were going out of their way to get our attention, sporting leather masks with ball gags, nun outfits with holes cut to expose their tits, nurse uniforms with enema bags, skin-tight red devil costumes with dildos for horns, and cowboy outfits with cans of shaving cream in the holsters. The weak among us cracked under the pressure, choosing girls backstage who offered something they hadn't tried before. During the show, we entered the stage by being shot up in front of 25,000 to 100,000 people from a contraption underneath the stage, as if we were 4 giant Pop-Tarts. Those contraptions eventually became a metaphor for the tour. Whenever we wanted to rest or sleep, all of a sudden someone would pull the lever and pop, there we would be. standing in front of a stadium full of cheering people ready to see the same song and dance we had been through hundreds of times already. For our whole lives, every one of us had fucking fantasized about being exactly where we were on that tour. But after 2 years, we came to hate and dread our jobs. Nikki liked to compare it to an erection. It feels great for a few minutes, but when it won't go down after hours of beating off, it starts to hurt like no other pain known to man. So we killed the pain like we always had. In Australia, Vince slipped off the wagon. After they scraped us off the floor in Australia and poured us into Japan, Nikki stumbled. And when they dragged us to Hawaii, I went to a strip club with Vince and fell victim to a big-titted waitress with a tray of Dayglo alcohol shooters and test tubes. Soon, with our relationships at home suffering from neglect, we were all sneaking alcohol, buying drugs, and reverting to our old self-destructive habits, with the possible exception of Mick, whose fiancé happened to be on the road with us as a backup singer. Near the end of the tour, Elektra sent over a film crew. They were having a massive sales conference with the buyers for all the record chains and thought that it would be a good idea for us to tape a message, sucking up to the retailers and thanking them for their support. So we gathered backstage in front of the crew, they started the cameras, and we behaved like good puppets. "Hey guys, we're Motley Crue, and we'd like to thank you for making our record number one." But then, suddenly, the puppet strings snapped. "And we want to let you know that we hate you and we hate Elektra. You guys aren't giving us a break. You're all a bunch of greedy fucking assholes, and we know where you live. And we're going to come slit your throats if you don't let us see our families." When the cameras shut off, we fucking collapsed on the floor and full-on sobbed. We couldn't even speak. We were so exhausted, so depleted, so devoid of all thought and emotion. Doug Thaler looked at us, shook his head, and said, "Maybe it's time we took you guys off the road for a little while." Dude, you've never seen four motherfuckers split up and go their own way faster than we did.
Part 9. Don't Go Away Mad. Chapter 1. In which the professors emeritus of rock and roll offer a dissertation developed during one of many periods of travel during which the rock and roll lifestyle is reduced to the curse of free time. The application of cog theory to the development and maturation of a common rock group by Tommy Lee, Mick Mars, Vince Neil, and Nikki Six, PhDs, Center for Studies in Popular Acoustics, Discordia University, Los Angeles, California. Summary. An Introduction to Cog Theory. Cog theory is an attempt to pull back the curtain of the popular music business and examine the mechanics of success. There is a machine which all musical artists are put through, hereafter referred to as the machine. See Figure 1. Artists' success in navigating their way through the intricate cogs, gears, hammers, and grinders of the machine determines the arc, scope, and course of their career. Such navigation requires talent, timing, luck, and a strong personal constitution. Motley Crue and Cog Theory, a stage-by-stage analysis. A. Stage 1. The platform and conveyor belt. At the bottom of the machine, there is a platform. And on that platform, there's a long line of artists who wait their turn to climb a ladder which leads to a conveyor belt. As the artists travel along that conveyor belt, they make and release a record. At the end of the conveyor belt is the first of several interconnected cogs, each higher and larger than the previous cog. If the artists time their jump at the end of the conveyor belt just right, they can land on the first cog. But most artists miss the cog and land on the platform again, at the rear of the line, or, in some cases, into the abyss below. Too Fast for Love as an independent release didn't even make the first cog. B. Stage 2. The first cog. Once artists reach the first cog and experience a degree of success, they become caught in the machinery. The gear is moving, the cog is rolling, and there's nothing that can be done to stop the machine. See Figure 1A. Soon, a second, larger cog looms ahead, the grinding of its bottom teeth adjoining and turning the first cog. Artists must jump at exactly the right time to catch the second cog. Otherwise, they will be crushed in the machinery between the cogs and either dropped back to the platform or rolled around to begin anew on the cog. Shouted the devil made it to the first cog, which tossed the band onto the second cog. C. Stage 3. The second cog. Once artists move as high as the second cog, it is a long way down to the bottom. See Figure 1B. They realize that the machinery is stronger than flesh, and that they are caught in it, and there is no way off. The machine tears skin, grinds limbs, and slowly infects and possesses the brain. If the act is a band, the machine can easily rip the members apart from each other and crush them individually. On the second cog, a band experiences true popularity. But to reach the next cog, the big cog, the final cog, the cog reserved for true phenomena, it is not just a matter of timing a long and arduous leap. Getting onto the big cog is something that is out of a band's control. That power is in the hands of the mighty cog god, a whimsical, wrathful, and unpredictable deity at the top of the machine, turning the gears. Motley Crue rolled around and around on the second cog, with Shout at the Devil, with Theater of Pain, with Girls, 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 and with each revolution, they narrowly avoided getting crushed and dropped to the bottom. Dr. Feelgood, however, caught the big cog. D. Stage 4. The Big Cog. The Big Cog is the cog that Guns N' Roses got caught on with Appetite for Destruction, that Metallica got caught on with their Black Album. It is the cog that Mariah Carey, the Backstreet Boys, and Eminem have all reached. The big cog is a huge grinding gear, and there's nothing artists can do about it if it picks them up. They can stand up and scream, "I hate everyone in the world and you all suck, and if you buy a single record of mine, I'll kill you." And all that will happen is more people will run out and buy their records. Trying to get off the cog is futile. It only makes the process hurt more. See Figure 1C. The big cog is exciting but overwhelming. Where the second cog can dig under the skin of artists, this one can tear them apart limb by limb. The cog gives artists everything they have ever dreamed of, everything they could ever want, except for privacy, solitude, friendship, stability, love, both familial and romantic, and peace of mind. With Dr. Feelgood on the big cog, Motley Crue could do no wrong. Every single they released terrorized the radio. Every show sold out, every blink of their eyes was reported in the papers. When the band first caught the big cog, it rolled along with the cog. But people get tired. The machine never stops moving. When the band can no longer keep pace, the big cog tore them apart, destroyed their marriages, and wrecked any chance of them leading a normal life, having any friends, or knowing what to do with themselves when not playing the machine game of recording and touring. Yet even when the band grew tired of running around on the big cog, the cruel and impersonal machine kept turning with them on top. The band put out a compilation of their favorite songs called Decade of Decadence, and it sold 2.5 million copies with hardly any promotion. Afterward, the business people whose job it is to stand on the outside of the machine monitor its behavior and see who is on what cog so that they can invest their money in them, much like the stock market, said to Motley Crue, "You guys are going to have the biggest tour of the summer." It was the last thing the band wanted to hear, because when artists are on the big cog, those who gamble their money on them don't want them to make new music or record new albums, because that is the quickest way off the cog and into the crusher. E. Stage 5. The Crusher. At the end of the big cog is a long, heavy rod with the circumference of a large tree trunk that shoots down from above at random intervals, crushing acts on their way off the big cog. Some acts have a lot of stamina and can run in place on the big cog and avoid the crusher for years, but most get worn down by the big cog. They are knocked off by the crusher and either drop to a lower cog, to the platform where they wait to return to the conveyor belt, or into the abyss below. Some, like Kurt Cobain, Jimi Hendrix, and Janis Joplin, get smashed completely by the crusher. And, in one sense, they win. The only way to beat the machine is to die, because that's the only way out of the game. When you win and make it to the big cog, you ultimately lose. There's no other way to go but down, and it's a painful drop no matter what. Those who survive are not the same after the fall. They experience post-COG stress disorder in which, like Axl Rose, they fool themselves into thinking that they are still on the big COG. With Motley Crue, we shall see in the following pages how the band was chewed up and spit out by the big COG, how lives and relationships were destroyed, and how post-COG stress disorder led to a tragic turn of events. Conclusion. A new beginning. There is no way to get off the machine without dying. Like sex, you want it over and over again, even when your organs don't work anymore. Success, or the desire for success, is a hard habit to kick. On the machine, an act can get second, third, and 18th chances. There's nothing keeping a band from reaching the first, second, or final COG again. The Rolling Stones have been dancing between COGs for years. Madonna has caught the big COG at least three times. And Santana spent a few years on the second COG around 1969, then rolled around on the conveyor belt for decades before his Supernatural album suddenly caught each COG until it dragged him to the top. We shall also see in the following pages how Motley Crue returned to the conveyor belt, how they caught COGs again, and how they were crushed and thrown around by the machinery as never before, leading them to prison cells, hospital beds, celebrity marriages, and worse. References: Dannon, Frederick, Hitman, Vintage Books, 1991. Kravalovsky, William M., and Sidney Schimmel, This Business of Music, Billboard Books, 1995. Sanjek, Russell, Pennies from Heaven, The American Popular Music Business in the 20th Century, Da Capo, 1996. Whitburn, Joel, Top Pop Albums, 1955 to 2000, Record Research, 2000. Guns N' Roses, The Spaghetti Incident? Geffen Records, 1992. Coming soon from the same authors. Divorce and Downloading Theory. An examination of the wireless communication system through which all females are linked, allowing constant telepathic surveillance of the activities of their mates. Chapter 2. Doug Thaler. In which a former manager of Motley Crue, with the power of precise date recall, chronicles the cruel revenge the big COG wreaked on our heroes. Ronnie James Dio changed my life. Twice. The first time, I graduated from Cortland State in New York in 1967 and joined his band, Ronnie Dio and the Prophets. Driving to Great Barrington, Massachusetts in our van, we were in a head-on collision and I almost lost my leg. I was in traction in Hartford when I received my physical notice for Vietnam. I looked at the doctor, and he told me not to worry. I wouldn't have to serve in the war. Years later, in the summer of 82, I was in Manhattan running tours for Contemporary Communications Corps when I received a call from Tom Zutaut. He said he had signed this group, Motley Crue, to Elektra and wanted to put them on the Aerosmith tour. He hinted that there might be management possibilities. However, I just put an old agency client of mine, Pat Travers, on the Aerosmith bill, so Zutaut was out of luck. Besides, David Krebs, the head of our company, didn't think it made any sense for a New York-based company to take on an L.A. client. I had heard of the Motley Crue once before Zutaut, when Hernando Courtright at A&M Records showed me the leather records release of Too Fast for Love and said he was high on it and wanted to sign the band. The cover was a cheesed-up picture that I later found out had been taken by a wedding photographer who had superimposed hair on the guys. It looked pretty comical, and I didn't think much about it. It was then that Ronnie James Dio came back into my life. He told me about a band with a flashy drummer that he liked. At the same time, Pat Travers' manager, Doc McGee, wanted me to join his company. I took him up on his offer on blind faith because I was going nowhere in my job. The first thing that Doc and I did together was head out to Los Angeles to see this band that Dio was talking about. It was Motley Crue again, and they knocked us out. They weren't nearly as cheesy as my first impression. The singer had a unique voice and raw energy. The music had a great pop twist to it, and the show was unbelievable. This was a hit act. You could take them anywhere in the world and put them in front of people, and they'd kill. As soon as I saw them, I knew that all the work I'd done in the business beforehand was like going to college so I'd know what to do with this band. From the beginning of the band's tour with Kiss, a work ethic materialized that I never expected. The guys turned into animals live. With Vince running all over the stage and Nikki exploding with bad boy attitude, they put on such a knockout show that they were upstaging Kiss. With the exception of only two or three shows, the band was so consistently good live through Shout, Girls, Theater, and the first two-thirds of Feel Good that the hair on the back of your neck would stand up at some point or another during every concert. But managing this band offstage was never easy. These are four damaged individuals. Vince is a California surfer rock guy, the peacock of peacocks who never really had to work for his fame. I think the ill will toward him began after the car crash with Razzle, because the group would be playing charity shows for him, and he'd go off drinking, fucking around, and putting the band's future at risk. To be fair, though, no one really understood the disease of alcoholism at the time. Mick Mars was the exact opposite of Vince, a guy who had wiped shit off his head for his whole life and was thankful just to have a moment in the sun, even if it ended the next day. Nicky was basically a nerd, except when he had Jack Daniels in him, which was just about every night. And Tommy was like a little kid, running around looking for mother and father figures. He could be the sweetest, most big-hearted kid in the world, or the most spoiled, temperamental brat. But it was always either Vince's behavior or Nicky's drug addiction that jeopardized the band. That changed, though, when the band sobered up for Feel Good, which was a tremendous triumph. The combination of the new sobriety, the stress from their marriages, and the attainment of a level of success beyond what they had ever imagined began to work a change in the band. Fear, exhaustion, and mood swings set in, and Tommy and Vince started falling off the wagon. Nicky, who had married a girl he had hardly even seen because he was so busy, became really distasteful to deal with. Everyone was blowing smoke up his ass, and he was starting to believe them. At the height of his powers, he was a marketing genius. But now he'd call the office pissed off because his carpenter thought Feel Good should have sold 7 million copies instead of just 4.5 million, and there was nothing we could do or say to calm him. I wanted the band to have a long time to work on their next album. I knew it would be very difficult to write a follow-up to Dr. Feel Good, and there was a chance that by waiting to record, they could get a new contract with Elektra that would earn them $25 million. At the same time, they needed downtime to deal with their new children. Within months of each other, Vince and Charisse had their first daughter, Skylar, and Nikki and Brandy had their first son, Gunner. And Tommy, left out, really started wanting to have a child of his own with Heather. As the new Elektra deal was being negotiated, things with the band kept going more haywire. Vince was getting back into drink again. He'd come to rehearsals for the new album a mess, and then leave early because he had to boff some porn star on his way home. By spring 1991, I had to call him and tell him that he wasn't welcome at rehearsals until he got his act together. So Vince grabbed some porn star, flew to Hawaii without telling us, and maxed out all his charge cards until he had to return home, where Charisse was impatiently waiting to kill him. He quickly pacified her. He was so good that if you walked into your bedroom and he was banging your wife, within 5 minutes he would have talked you out of believing what you had just seen. Then he took a plane to Tucson and checked himself into rehab. We all flew down there and met with Vince, encouraging him to make the band a priority, and explaining that